And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. Michael Lauk will be joining us for the news in just a sec. After the news, we have a great interview with Grant Cameron. He's been around the scene, I should say the UFO scene, since 1975. So how you doing, Michael? What's up for the news this week?
Well, this week we have a few UFO sightings and some science news. First, though, I'd like to remind everyone to visit podcastufo.com to check out the show notes with links to media coverage of all of our news stories. While you are there, be sure to take a second to join the forums. Of course, you can always find us on our active Facebook page as well. And I'd also like to thank Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse, who composed and provided today's music. Well, first up, we have a Florida security camera catching mysterious lights over a pool. And everybody, you're going to want to go to the show notes and look at this. A Florida condo security guard saw something off and so far unexplained in one swimming pool security camera feed Monday night. The view is partially obscured by condensation, making identification even more difficult. But some strange light does appear to hover over and perhaps even enter the water. Visit our show notes for a link to the local NBC News coverage out of Naples, Florida, and about 1 minute of the security footage. Now, Martin, did you get a chance to see this?
Oh, yes. And, you know, my son was visiting last night, so we watched it together. And, you know, he tries to keep a very, I would say, a skeptical mind when he's observing about every single UFO video that I've ever shown him, which is good, you know, healthy and whatever. But, you know, right away he says that it's like maybe a sprinkler hit that thing, you know, and it's a globe over the security camera. And I said, no, it looks to me like something electrical and back and forth. But, you know, all of a sudden he said, if that was going on for 30 minutes and the woman was watching it, why didn't she go out and take a look? And
that is exactly what I wondered.
And is there any answer to that? I can't find anything.
No, except that maybe her job does not cover fighting off an alien invasion.
Oh, you know, I usually don't see that type of thing in a job application myself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I have to admit, when I watched the news coverage, I was very unimpressed because there's definitely water on the camera housing. Mm-hmm. For the security camera. They show the security camera. It's in one of the bubbles. It's one of the small ones.
Right.
But when you watch the separate, they have about a minute, I think 54, 55 seconds pulled up. When you watch that, you do get a little bit better idea of what went on, because they say, you know, oh, at first it looks like something, you know, that's a disc, and it doesn't look like a disc. It's obviously some kind of light haloing in this water drop that's over the lens. But after that, whatever it is does – It's a light, and it goes down, and it moves up and down through some of the water that's covering that lens. So it starts to look a little different, and then it does kind of look like it might even go in the swimming pool. It was odd. I'm not ready to call it a UFO, but I definitely, same thing. I wondered, let's say it's not a UFO. Let's assume it is someone with a flashlight. Isn't that exactly your job? Go out and be like, what the hell are you doing?
Sitting behind a desk.
In my day, security guards totally would have chased us off.
Yeah. Yeah, she wasn't exactly like a brawny security guard. She was, you know, just a sort of a petite woman. Actually kind of cute. Did you notice that? You're not going to say, are you? You're going to pass
keep quiet
on
that.
Yeah, okay.
Sometimes my wife might actually listen someday. Oh. You never know.
Okay.
And in other news, a New Zealand man encounters a UFO. Tuesday night, a man from Ruther Glen, New Zealand, claims to have seen a quote-unquote car-shaped UFO. After the encounter, he had no cell phone reception, blurred vision, and watery eyes. He was, in fact, described as bug-eyed and visibly shaken by the event. There are no pictures or video from the man, but he is hoping that someone else in the area can confirm his sighting. What attracted me to this one is I don't think I've ever seen or heard a description of a car-shaped UFO before. Have you?
No, but that would definitely explain time travel right there.
think it was Marty McFly?
Marty McFly, absolutely. No, you know, it's funny. My son, I was reading him this while he was doing something on his computer, and he just kind of shook his head a few times. So the bug-eyed thing is, you know, visibly shaking, but bug-eyed? I haven't heard that description yet. So maybe it was a Volkswagen bug. I don't know.
I wasn't sure if he was bug-eyed due to shock or if he actually, as his eyes were watering, if something had affected his eyes. They weren't very clear on that. Maybe if we have any New Zealand listeners, if there's some more coverage of that, they can let us know what's going on.
Yeah, we need an entomologist, maybe. Yeah.
And there have been multiple UFO sightings over California. The OC Weekly has a short and somewhat snarky article on an increase in unexplained aerial objects spotted in the area. The article does, though, include two videos of area sightings and a still shot of one. The object shown appears to be round or ovular and moving, but in all fairness, it could simply be a tossed ball. And you can find, of course, all that in the link in our show notes. Did you see either of those videos?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I looked everything over last night. And it looks like, you know, the shape and size of a beach ball at a distance. You know, that's like the first thing you think of. And it's a still picture. It's not a video. Did you find a video of that?
I mean, there is a video on the page that features it, but it is just a video made up of still pictures and close-up of the still pictures. So,
yeah, and at the end of that video, it shows these little dots off in the distance, and it says UFOs circled in red. Did you see that?
I did, and
what does that mean? I mean, that could be a birds or anything.
Stars. Yeah, it could have been anything. That was that wasn't maybe the most convincing, but they're having area sightings, and it's worth reporting, right?
Yeah, and the other one was lights in the sky, and, you know, lights in the sky are lights in the sky, as they say. You know, awful hard to explain. It could be, of course, the infamous Chinese lanterns or all kinds of things. It's very inconclusive.
Well, the one thing is that still picture is not a Chinese lantern.
Haven't seen one like that yet. No.
On to a better picture, I thought. Dorset man photographs a strange light, and the International Business Times is reporting on a strange series of photographs taken by a man in Dorset, which is in southwest England. The article reports that some readers have theorized the strange lights are merely the sun reflecting off paragliders, even though the photographs appear to have been taken after dark. Did you get a chance to look at those?
Yeah, I did. Sure looked like electrical anomalies of some kind.
It was a little bit stranger. You know, without knowing the camera and the details, it's hard to say what it was. But I think sun glinting off paragliders was just a little bit ridiculous.
Yeah, that was silly. But, you know, there's some type of spectrum of strange colors there together. It is strange.
And finally, a couple Space.com stories. First up, Space.com is reporting that NASA scientists believe that the sun's magnetic field is preparing to flip, with magnetic north and south poles changing places. This does occur approximately every 11 years, so it is not a terrible shock or surprise, but it does indicate that solar activity will be increasing. Also reported on at Space.com is that NASA scientists are trying to find a new mission for the Kepler Space Telescope. As listeners may recall, a malfunction keeps it from being able to make the fine maneuvers necessary for optimal performance. Therefore, it really can't hunt planets anymore. But now that it is unable to function as designed, they are hoping that there is some use that they can get out of the space telescope with the capabilities that it still has.
I have a perfect solution to this. Why don't we just spy on Americans with it?
Do you want to spy on the security guard from the first story?
Yeah, but also... That's right. But also, you know, the heck with the emails and the internet, you know, that they're getting our records on. Why don't we just spy right through bedroom windows?
Don't you think they already have something that does that?
They probably do.
Well, I was wondering if they couldn't maybe use it to look for near-Earth objects. It's maybe not fine enough anymore for those extreme long-distance photographs it was taking. But maybe, you know, maybe it'll help us not eat a giant space rock.
You know, there you go, getting all logical again. Jeez.
I don't want to get hit with a giant space rock, all right? Yeah. That's just my personal thing. That's every day I wake up and go, man, I hope we don't get hit by an Armageddon-sized space rock. That'll suck.
So that's it for the news, right, Michael?
That is it for this week.
All right, so hang in there. There's a clip by Kerry Lloyd Whitehouse and Grant Cameron's coming up.
All right, great. Talk to you next week.
Hi, Grant. How are you?
Good, Martin. Thanks for showing some interest and having me on your show.
Absolutely. You're very welcome and glad to have you on. Now, I read your book a little while ago, three or four months ago, UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants. And that was co-authored by T. Scott Crane, is that right?
Yes.
It looks like it took a long time to compile that book. Can you talk about that?
Well, it was actually the second time it's been out. It was the first book that was ever published by MUFON back in 1991. At that time, it was called UFOs, MJ-12, and the Government. And it was sort of, as you've read the book, you know, it was sort of the majority of the book at that point was based on us chasing around a guy by the name of Dr. Eric Walker, who was the former president of Penn State University. And T. Scott Crane got a journalism degree from Penn State, was right there. So he was the co-author. And we put the book out. And then 20 years later, Richard Dolan used it in UFOs National Security Part 2 and used some of the material from the Walker and some of the Canadian stuff that I had in there. And then sort of came up with the idea that he wanted to publish it. So I said, yeah, okay. So then we updated the book and we I did most of the updating. The original was written by T. Scott Crane based on my research, but I did most of the updating because Scott hadn't really been involved in UFOs for 20 years. So I updated it and we changed the MJ-12 to Area 51, not because MJ-12 wasn't important. In fact, I've just put out an article that presents new evidence on MJ-12. But the fact that majority of the people, if you talk to people on the street, they look at you like they look at you like you're crazy already. But when you talk about MJ-12, they have no idea what you're talking about. So Area 51, I knew by Google searching it and working on it that it was it is one of the most popular, most well-known places in the world. And the biggest article I ever wrote got the most hits on my website was the Area 51 article. So that's why we changed the title to UFOs, Area 51 and Government Informants. So we go into the sort of one of the sub-premises of the book was a theory that I've got that the government has been indirectly leaking a lot of the UFO material to the UFO community surrounded by disinformation. So they're able to allow the sort of the concepts to come out, but they're able to maintain the classified nature of the program that they're running. And so that's why we talked about government informants, all these sort of people that sort of have come forward and sort of dropped all sorts of hints as to what's going on.
Right. But going back to Walker, what I do in the real world is I do a lot of historical research on documents. And I got to tell you, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that initialing is by the same hand that made the signatures, Walker. And I do, like I say, a good part of what I do is a lot of research on signatures. And that's right on target.
This is actually kind of interesting because one of the articles, I'm writing another book now, and I'm dealing with this idea of the live alien. And that was sort of something that I think he was indirectly trying to tell us. It really didn't mean that there was all for real. You'll see in one of the interviews that we do with him where he's talking about the fact he's being asked about the bodies, the Roswell bodies. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, how do you know they didn't get up and walk away? Everything you're doing, you're guessing. And most of what you're guessing is wrong. And then he puts out this alien letter that sort of indicates that there's these four aliens and they're integrated into American society. But I don't think he was really saying, you know, that this was actually for real. He was giving us the idea that there was a live alien, that that not all of them are dead. And in 1991, when we were doing these interviews, the idea of the live alien wasn't all that prominent. But now with the work of Kerry and Schmidt and even Randall, we now are pretty certain that the Roswell crash involved a live alien. In fact, there's a document. I didn't put it in the book, but there's actually a document back in 1952 that was a letter that was written to Frank Scully, who was the guy who wrote the first crash saucer book, the one on the Aztec crash. And Frank Scully gets a letter from a woman in New York who basically talks about the fact that her daughter, they run into this guy, they're fixing a tire, and I think it's in Nevada, and this guy tells her daughter, starts dating her daughter, and starts telling her daughter that he's involved in this program and there's a live alien and they have it in New Mexico. And this is 1952. So I always try to remind people that, you know, we have the story of the live alien and all that sort of stuff now, but I've been around this field long enough to know that what we talk about now wasn't talked about then. In fact, the first time that crashed saucers and actual dead aliens and autopsies was talked about was 1978. Before that, there was really no discussion whatsoever. And I remember going to the – it was done at the MUFON conference in Dayton, Ohio, and I remember being there. And I had a meeting with Len Stringfield related to something else, not his speech. And that's where he was giving this speech about the live aliens. And I went there and they had moved him to another hotel and there was all the death threats. And it was like it was just real tension in the room about this guy that was going to talk about alien autopsies and stuff like that. So to have this live alien letter in 1952, I think is fairly significant in that we now have a lot of people who are talking about the fact that there was a live alien in 1947. But the discussion of that didn't come till about 10 years ago when these witnesses started to come forward.
Yeah. So do you think that Walker was trying to push you a bunch of disinformation by some of the things he was...
No, he's giving you information, but that the way I say they do it is you can't – let me give you an example. You know the story of Chase Brandon, the CIA guy.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so Chase Brandon comes out and he's doing this fictional book on Roswell. And if you hear the interviews that he does about six interviews on the book, and he says, if you want a good read, read the book. If you really want to learn something, read between the lines. And that's the way I say they do it, is that you get a situation where if you're a CIA guy and you saved America from imminent disaster from Russian bombs or whatever, and you decide that you want your children and grandchildren to know the story of what you did, you go to the CIA and they say, yeah, Martin, you can write up your story, but here's what you got to do. And this is what they told Chase Brandon. You got to change the names. You got to change, tip all the classified material. It has to be reviewed by the CIA. And you have to fictionalize the story. So that's the way they get this material out, is they do exactly what a CIA agent does when he tells his story, is they fictionalize it. So when Chase Brandon comes out and Chase Brandon says, I mean, Roswell's for real. I mean, basically here you have a guy who's a very high level CIA guy. And nobody really picks up on it. The New York Times doesn't pick up, but Washington Post doesn't pick up. And sort of the idea gets out that something's going on. But the cover-up is maintained, and I think that's basically what they're doing. So when Walker was doing this, he knew the principle. He knew the principle that you don't give away anything classified. So when Chase Brandon is telling the story, he's basically asked, well, how do you know? And I say he makes up the story. There's no such box. He says, I'm at Langley headquarters. I'm in the collection area where all the archives boxes are. I'm sitting there waiting for a TV crew to come in. And I've got nothing to do, so I start looking around, and I see this box with Roswell on the side of it, which I say doesn't exist, because you can't talk about classified material. You can fictionalize the whole thing. So he fictionalized this idea about a box, the same as 15 years ago when it was the 50th anniversary of Roswell, you had Corso come forward. And Corso tells a story about, well, he was looking in the filing cabinet, and here they had left all this crash material from Roswell in some filing cabinet, and he happened to find it. And so you fictionalize the story. So he talks about the box. And when he's asked in these six interviews, he said, what was in the box convinced me absolutely for sure that Roswell was extraterrestrial and there were cadavers. So he says that very categorically. Then he's asked, well, what was in the box? He says, you can do whatever you want. I cannot tell you what was in the box. I cannot. I can just say that it confirmed that Roswell was real and there were cadavers. So the whole point is that he can talk about this fictionalized box. He can talk about the fact that there is evidence. But if he says there's a photograph that shows an alien and it was taken in 1947 and it was taken by certain people, that's classified material. You can't talk about that. You can't talk about a certain document you saw. So you sort of talk about the thing without getting to the classified material. And let me give you another example, and we talk about this in the book. There's in 1972-73, there's two film producers by the name of Robert Emmenegger and Alan Sandler are contacted by the Pentagon. And they're told that the regular Pentagon company that they were supposed to hire is in trouble because they're doing a thing on the Pentagon Papers and they messed it up, some documentary. So these guys have been called in and they want them to do some documentaries on the U.S. military and to make the U.S. military look better. And they're going to do 3D holography and they're going to do working with dolphins and all sorts of bizarre things that the military is working on. And there's about eight different programs. So they get taken around and they're given these things, your work on this program, that program. And then Paul Schartl, they're at Norton Air Force Base in a clean room where the CIA does their filming. They're in this clean room. And Paul Schartl is a security manager. And Paul says to him, what would you say if I told you that we had filmed a craft landing at Holloman Air Force Base from three different angles, one from helicopter, two from the ground, 6 o'clock in the morning, and that the aliens got out and meted officials and whatever. And we'd like you to do this documentary, and we'd like you to talk about this film. So basically, they start off on this program, and they're basically allowed to go into the Pentagon. They don't have to sign in. They're put in contact with anybody they want, and they put this whole documentary out. So at the end, when they have this film, and at the very end, the Pentagon comes. Bill Coleman, who's working at the Pentagon, says to them, he said, well, you have to send the film back. You can't use the film. Because it's Watergate, we got problems, it's not the political right time to do it. So they pull the film, and they say, you got to bring the film back. So the film is sent back to the Pentagon. Some guy drives it in a small Datsun across the country, takes it back to the Pentagon. But when the film is released, there's 8 seconds of the film. And this sort of becomes a rumor, and I know Bob very well, so I'm talking to Bob, and I said, Bob, there's 8 seconds of the film in there. There's 8 seconds of the Holloman Air Force Base film used in the film. And he sort of hesitates and he goes, yeah, well, he said, but it's just background. And I said, well, why would they let you use it? And he said, well, because it's just background. There's nothing classified. And that's the same thing. What it shows, if you look at the Holloman thing, what they're forced to do is they're used to forced to use storyboard, and they're forced to sort of do, you know, drawings and stuff like that to tell this story that this might have happened in the past or it might happen in the future. And they're telling this story about the landing at Holloman Air Force Base. And all of a sudden they've got this 8 seconds where you see this object coming over the hill, and it's sort of a glowing white object during the day. It's coming over the Holloman, hills. And you can very clearly see that this has been cut into the film. And so I'm pressing him on this. And I said, well, what do you mean background? And he said, well, it didn't show the craft and it didn't show the aliens. And that's this whole thing about classified material. The same thing Walker was doing, the same thing that Chase Brandon was doing, was you can show a light coming over a hill and say, you know, this is the craft, and sort of indirectly, or not even say it's the craft, but show the craft, but you can't show the alien up close because that's classified, or show the actual saucer sitting on the ground. That's classified material. But you can show this sort of nebulous thing, which they call background. It really doesn't tell you anything, but they actually have part of the actual film that was taken at Holloman Air Force Base when this thing landed there. So that's this whole idea that I came up with, and I produce a number of examples in the book to show how they do this. And what they want you to know is they want you to know there was a crash in Roswell, New Mexico. They want you to know there was a live alien. They want you to know that they've been working on this whole thing. They want you to know that there's an MJ-12. There's a group controlling this whole thing. They want you to know the basic sort of core story. But when it comes to actually spilling the milk, that they don't want to do. Because once the story's out and somebody stands up and says, this is for real, then you can't take the story back and you sort of lose control of the story. So they're working on the classified aspects, which is building weapons, building the mind control stuff, all that kind of stuff that they get from the technology. The actual confirmation that this is for real, they withhold, that's classified. But they want you to know the core story of what's going on. And that's sort of the premise of the book that I set out to prove that this is the kind of stuff that's going on. Or the Area 51, the prime story. They want you to know that Area 51 had a live alien. They want you to know they were back engineering stuff at Area 51. And they use a very specific way of bringing that story out, which sort of backfires. But I go through the whole story and describe how I know that this was purposely done at Area 51. They purposely put this story out.
Now, you and I had an email exchange way back before I started reading the book. And okay. I had just told you that I had just got the book in the mail and all that. And you told me at that time that there was, had I heard about the controversy about your book. Does that have to do with the MJ-12 documents, as that always seems to be in the middle of controversy?
No, that's about to happen. There, I put the Area 50, the Majestic 12 thing out in the book twice. We put it out in 1991, and nobody picked up on it. For example, we had a woman who claimed to have seen the MJ-12 document in Okinawa, and they were on a declassification team. They were in a general's office. They found this document. We put that in the original book, and the military picked up on it. She was furious. She was going to sue us. She was absolutely furious. We had withheld her name, sort of tried to cover who she was. But I guess if you're on a declassification team and you're a woman, I mean, they can sort of go back and figure out who was on this declassification team. where the general's office was, who it was, you know, what we gave the date and all this sort of stuff. Nobody ever picked up on that. We put that thing out. We put a couple things in the first book that nobody ever picked up on. It was like nobody ever read the book. And so in the second, we put the same thing. We put all the MJ-12. I listed all the material that showed that there was an MJ-12 group. Forget about the document. I always say the document is not legitimate. And I say it's not legitimate because there was a live alien. And the document says there's four dead aliens. There was three dead and one live. And I think we know that pretty well for sure now, or that's the general belief. So what they've done with the document is you put the document out and you change parts of the document so that if it comes back to you, you say, well, it's a hoax. It's a phony document. Well, you know it's a phony document because you made it. But basically all the right material is in the document to tell you what's going on. So we put that out, but that never became controversial. What became controversial this time when I released it, there was a couple of things. One was Robert Collins was upset about my sort of spin on the Bill Moore story about the birds, about who was who.
You mean the falcon and all that?
The falcon and stuff, and that I had some of it wrong, and that I had taken his material and put my spin on it. But it came down to who were the different birds and what was actually going on there. There was that controversy. And the other controversy was from Lee Graham. Lee Graham, if you know the MJ-12 story, what had happened was Bill Moore and Jamie Chandray were both CIA operatives. Okay, so they had been assets. They both worked for the CIA. They both had this interaction. And that's how they were able to accumulate these Avery sources. And what the Avery were they were 12 intelligence, mostly intelligence people, that they had collected from the inside. And because they had these intelligence connections, they could go in there and they could be trusted to shut their mouth when they were told to say something, to do what they're told to do, and stuff like that. And so both of them had this background, and they accumulated these 12 sources. And two of them, I think, were CIA directors. I think one was Richard Helms, and I think the other one was Robert Gates. And one of the rumored stories was that Kissinger was also one of the people that was feeding them material. So they're working with this whole thing. And what would happen was in 1984, they received the MJ-12 document. It comes in Jamie Chandray's mailbox. And the question at that time always was, well, Jamie Chandray wasn't even a ufologist. He was a film producer in Los Angeles. And the question was always, well, why didn't they send it to Moore? Why did they send it to Jamie Chandray? Well, because Jamie Chandray had an intelligence background. And when you look at these stories, there's always a guy with an intelligence background. Like the Emmenager Sandler thing, Sandler had the intelligence background. There's always somebody who's got an intelligence background who's able to sort of negotiate and pull this stuff out. So the document comes in 1984. And they don't release it until 1987. And they're actually forced to release the document. And they're forced because they're withholding it. They're trying to research the document. They're trying to get to the bottom of it. And then they get the warning from the Falcon that it's about to be released in Britain. And if you want to make a move, you better release it now. And that's what they had done, is they had leaked the document to Tim Good in Great Britain. And in his book, Above Top Secret, he was releasing the document as well. So Moore was forced to release the document. But what they had done in part of the analysis that they had done on the document is they used a guy by the name of Lee Graham. Lee Graham was an aviation buff who worked for Skunk Works. And he had gone on from Skunk Works to work on a satellite program. So he was working in the aerospace industry. And he was very interested in all this kind of stuff. And what they would do is every document that Bill Moore would get through these channels, through Falcon, through whatever, they would give it to Lee Graham. And Lee Graham would immediately take it, and he would give it to a security officer at Aerojet, where he worked, this satellite company. And, of course, this would initiate a security investigation. And Lee Graham actually lost his job. In the end, he was forced to resign years later because of this whole thing. But he would hand it in, and, of course, then the Defense Investigative Services would get involved, and Lee Graham would be investigated, and they would investigate. And that's what they were trying to do, is they were trying to get an official investigation on a document. That's how they did it. So Lee Graham was involved in this whole process through all the years. For example, he was the first guy to get the MJ-12 document. He was the first guy to get a document called the Blue Room document. Bill Moore had gotten this document that dealt with it was called the Blue Room Radar Scope document out of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And this document tied into the Blue Room, which was this rumored room where the bodies and the crafts were kept. And so these documents were given to Lee Graham, and he would hand them in to security officer. So Lee Graham became this sort of a guy that was in the middle of these investigations, and he also filed, some people said as many as one of the documents said as many as 5,000 FOAs. He would put FOAs on the MJ-12 document, and he's still filing them with Obama, and he's got me dragged into these things now. And what happened was, in the end, he would send me all this material, and Moore was giving him all this material, including an actual drawing or a picture of an alien face that he had been shown. And Lee Graham drew it, and you'll see we put it in the book and stuff like that.
Right.
And so in the end, Lee Graham had an interpretation of what he thought was going on. So when I used Lee Graham's material, and he'd filed FOIAs, and he'd put this material out, so he'd send it to me. So it was, as far as I was concerned, it was open source material. I didn't degrade Lee Graham. I basically didn't twist his story. I said, this is what happened. Lee Graham did this, investigative services got involved or whatever. But because I didn't tell Lee Graham's story the way he thought it should be told, he had this idea about time travel, and he didn't believe the Falcon was the CIA guy. He believed it was Hennessy from the guy that was the head of all the Air Force security programs, Air Force security. So he disagreed with some of the interpretations I had. It was the same as Robert Collins. And because I used the material and didn't come to their interpretation of the results, they were upset that I was using this material. So those were the two controversy. And the other controversy I got into was at the and this one nobody picked up either. It was kind of weird. This was happened at the citizens' hearing. I find in the UFO community that a lot of UFO people were as bad as the government, if not worse, when it comes to keeping stuff secret. And there was one particular thing that I released, and it was just the way I worded it. It wasn't it put somebody's – the name of the person who had sort of talked to me about this, and it dealt with a guy at Area 51. And we talk about – in the book I talk about him, but I don't use his name because at that point I didn't know the story. And the guy's name actually turns out to be Alfred O'Donnell, and he is one of the top guys, EG&G, at Area 51. And he basically confirms the fact that it's all for real. The live alien story is for real, and the back engineering's for real. What happens is this: Alfred O'Donnell stops talking in 1992. And the reason he stops talking is because he has been contacted by a fellow by the name of Dick D'Amato, who was a investigator for the Appropriations Committee. He had been working for Senator Byrd, ran the Appropriations Committee, and a number of the senators on the Appropriations Committee got concerned when the Area 51 story first broke. The importance of the Appropriations Committee is they are the guys that sort of authorize all the money that's spent in the U.S. budget. So when all the stories started coming out about the fact that we had flying saucers and we were back engineering all this stuff, Byrd and all the people in the senators on the Appropriations Committee were sort of looking at each other and going, like, are we financing flying saucers? Nobody's told us about this. We're paying for this. We're the guys that appropriate the money. And we better look into this. So they send D'Amato to Area 51 to find out what the heck's going on. What are we actually building flying saucers? So D'Amato gets on there and he tries to interview this O'Donnell guy. O'Donnell says, I'm not going to talk about it, even though D'Amato knows that he knows the story. He says, you got to talk to my boss. So he goes to his boss, and the boss says, well, you know, I really wasn't involved in this, and I really don't know anything about this live alien thing and the flying saucers. I don't care if he wants to talk about it. I don't care. He can talk about it. And so they go back to O'Donnell, and O'Donnell doesn't talk. He says, no, I'm not going to talk about it. And he shuts up. This is about 1992. O'Donnell won't talk anymore. So I release this at citizen's hearing, and I get all sorts of flack about the fact that, you know, I can't keep my mouth shut and whatever. And to me, it's the old idea. It's like, you know, how did they know that O'Donnell was there in 1992? It was the same people squealing on him. This story's been open since 1992. Just I'm the first guy to come out and use his name. But you get into this flack of people having all these confidential sources for different things. And to me, it's like, I always look at it like MJ-12 too. I got involved sort of with the Avery, and that sort of fell through a number of years ago, that I released the fact that somebody had talked to two U.S. presidents. And I got this flack about, you know, this was confidential, you can't keep your mouth shut and all this sort of stuff. And it was like, well, this is like MJ-12 too. I mean, so what? You 12 intelligence guys figure this thing out. How does that help society? It doesn't help anybody. And that's what's happening is we have sort of like in the UFO community, we have a lot of people who have a lot of material that they don't release. A lot of very highly classified, not classified, but really important stuff. Like as I said, I have a guy who had conversations with two U.S. presidents. But because this is all secret, it's like, well, you can't talk about this. And it's like, well, what's the point? So you did this, and it's like a bunch of guys that symbolize it as a bunch of guys who have stolen a bunch of Picasso paintings. And they every once in a while they get together in some guy's basement and they show off their Picasso paintings to each other. But the public is never going to see those paintings. And the only people that can see it is people who they really trust in secrecy. So these are sort of the controversies that I got in the book and after the book. The fact that, you know, that this material that I'm releasing and people either say that I shouldn't have released the material or that I'm not interpreting the material the way it should. And the way I work in ufology is I say, I'm getting on. I mean, I'm close to 60 years old now. I've been in this since, you know, 1975. I've been in a long time. I'm running out of time. I'm not here to play games. And my idea is I will put as much of what I have on the table as possible, hoping that somebody somewhere has something that will say, hey, I can verify that. Thank you for putting this out because I can use this. We have to get as much of the material out as possible. It doesn't help to withhold stuff, to keep stuff secret. The government's doing a good job of that. We don't need to help them do this kind of stuff. So that's basically how this came down. And what I did in the book is I tried to put as much as I could on the table, and I still work on it. And what I do a lot of is I actually do a lot of research in terms of going and finding people's files. Like when a researcher dies or puts his file somewhere, I go to those files for a very specific reason because I know everybody's got secrets that they never told. So you go into the files and you want to see what cases did that guy never release? Who was he talking to? What confidential conversations did he have with people? And I look for that kind of material, believing that, you know, we're running out of time. Well, I'm running out of time in terms of trying to figure out what this was. Because when I started, as you know, people will know my story, that 1975, there was a series of sightings happened here just north of the American border.
Is that Charlie Red Star?
Red Star story, yeah. Mm-hmm. And this happened 2 weeks. My first sighting was 2 weeks after the end of the Vietnam War. It started just before the end of the Vietnam War. I believe it had to do with the Vietnam War. That what had happened is I live right by the Minuteman missile silos in North Dakota. In North Dakota, they always said, North Dakota was a country, it would be one of the biggest nuclear powers in the world. We had the Grand Forks missile base with all the Minutemen's. We had the Minot base. We had missiles everywhere. We all knew this. But when I had the sightings, I really didn't know what was going on. It was a small town, farming community, flat as could be, nothing significant. Huge numbers of sightings, 59% when I polled the high school, 59% of the kids said they'd seen something in the last 2 years. A lot of sightings. And I could never figure out why these sightings were taking place. And 30 years later, I went back to the guy who ran the airport who had more sightings than I did. I had about 100 over a year and a half that I was there trying to investigate this. He had about 150. So I said to him, I said, Bob, I said, well, why was this going on? He said, well, you know why. And I said, no, Bob, in 30 years, I have no idea what was going on here. He said, the missile silos. I told you it was the missile silos. They were coming from the States. I told you that. We'd watched them fly up from the States. So I linked it into this whole U.S. missile thing. So when I put out the manuscript back in 1977, nobody would publish a thing. And the local publisher, and I live in a pretty big city, 750,000 people, the local publisher here where the story was very popular basically wouldn't publish it. And her rejection letter said, Mr. Cameron, you may believe in this kind of stuff. Count me among the unbelievers. And so I said, sightings, total waste of time. This is garbage. I mean, you can tell people stories and dazzle them and people are going, yeah, it's kind of interesting. Nobody cares. Nobody could care less about what you saw or anybody else saw. I said, all I'm interested in now is what did I see? Somebody has to know what I saw. Somebody has to know more about what's going on. There has to be someone with an answer. And that's why I started this investigation going after the Canadian government to find out what the Canadian government did. I put that in the book. And then that led us to Dr. Eric Walker, and we spent 8 years chasing him around. We put everything in the book. And at one point, Scott Crane, because there was some of the stuff, as you see the Walker stuff, some of it was kind of weird. I mean, we were talking about the live aliens being integrated into American society. So Scott said, well, let's edit this stuff. I said, no, let's not edit anything. Let's just take everything that he told us, every letter, every conversation. Let's not edit anything. Let's just put it in there, the good stuff, the bad stuff, and let people determine that we, this is what he told us. So I haven't really edited anything there. And then when I got to the, he led to the presidents, that we, there was a set of files that he, because he was, he had a lot of powerful jobs, this guy. He was the co-developer of the homing torpedo during World War II. He was chairman of the board of the Institute for Defense Analysis, which is the biggest or the most powerful think tank for the U.S. Department of Defense. That's where DARPA came out of. DARPA emerged out of the Institute for Defense Analysis. He was the job that we were trying to get his records for. He was the executive secretary of the Research and Development Board, which was the organization after World War II that was in charge of all the weapon development, the hydrogen bomb, all the latest armaments and stuff like that. So he was the executive secretary. So he was second in command in the Pentagon for all the weapon development in 1950. And that's when he got involved. That's when we sort of find out that he goes to these briefings at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. What we're told is by Dr. Robert Sarbacher, who is one of the people who squeals on him. Sarbacher says there was a crash in the West. He didn't know where it was, and that the material had been taken to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and that this, he didn't give the date, but we figured it was 1950. There was a series of briefings that had been taken place for high-ranking scientists in Washington, and that Sarbacher couldn't go. He said, I couldn't go to the briefings, but a lot of people, I was in a Navy office in Washington, and a lot of the people who were briefed, scientists and stuff, were coming back to the Navy office, and we're talking about what they were being told. And he remembered that the alien was like an insect-type creature. It had like a characteristics of an insect, and that the material was very, very light, and it was very, very tough. So these are the things he remembered. And Stanton Friedman interviews him, and this is 1983 on tape. And Sarbacher says, Stanton's asking him, well, who was there? And he said, well, Vannevar Bush, who was the guy, the science advisor to President Roosevelt, the guy in charge of the atomic bomb, the guy that's rumored to be in charge of the flying saucer thing. When it first started, the Roswell thing, he was the guy that was running the flying saucer program. He mentions von Braun from Saturn V. He mentions von Neumann, who's been sort of credited with inventing the computer. He's naming off all these guys, and Stanton says to him, well, Robert, I mean, you're naming all these guys that are dead. Is there anybody that could possibly still be alive? And that's when he said, well, yeah, there was this guy from Pennsylvania. He was real arrogant, man. That guy went to every meeting. He thought he knew everything. And that's when we analyze and we find out a researcher in California determines that this is Dr. Eric Walker. Mm-hmm. And that's when he phones him up and he says, you know, this is like days after the MJ-12 document was released in 1987. And he says, you know, I understand from Dr. Robert Sarbacher that you attended a series of briefings at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and it dealt with the recovery of a flying saucer and extraterrestrial bodies. And Walker says, yeah, I was there. What do you want to know about that for? And, and Steinman gets freaking out. Wow, this is the most important subject in the world. And then Walker saying, well, calm down. What's the big thing? And this is how this thing starts, that we figure out that this Walker knows. I mean, he basically
doesn't deny anything, right?
Doesn't deny anything. And then even when Steinman says to him, he says, I've got this document talking about MJ-12, and he cuts him off and he says, look, I've known of them for 40 years. Leave it alone. There's nothing you can do about it. So from this 1987, days after the document comes out, and it's not public. It was released at the MUFON conference in Washington, but it's not public in newspapers or anything. And Walker says, I've known of them, MJ-12. I've known of them for 40 years. It's 1987. He's known of them since 1947. So we knew it instinctively that this was a critically important guy. This guy knew what was going on. He had done some studies on engineering for President Eisenhower. The president before him at Penn State University that appointed him vice president was Milton Eisenhower, who was the president's brother. So a very, very powerful guy. And so we basically sort of do everything we can to get him to talk. And even after the book is released in 1991, the first version of this book that we've just released, in 1991, we suddenly – it sort of occurs to me, he's doing an interview with Stanton Friedman, and Stanton really had problems with him because he would never talk to Stanton. Stanton said to me, he said, well, you know, the guy is evident he knows something, but what you can't squeeze it out of him, you know, you can't make him talk. And so he wouldn't tell Stanton, but he did tell Stanton something very significant. Stanton interviewed him in 1990, and Stanton, he was making some cracks about the Roswell book, and he was sort of, you know, saying various things like that. And then he said, you know, I was only involved in this for a couple of days, and I haven't been involved for 25 years. And after the book was released, I suddenly went, wow, you know, 1990 was the interview. You go back 25 years, if he was involved for a couple of days, that was 1965. That was the crash at Kecksburg, Pennsylvania. So I go and I look on a map, and sure enough, it's like 100 miles away from Penn State University. And Dr. Eric Walker had an aviation license. He was a pilot. They had an airport right at Penn State University because they were training pilots there, just commercial pilot type stuff. And so I went, wow, he could just jump on a plane. He could be in Kecksburg in 30 minutes. And I mean, he'd be in and out of there. So we phoned him up, even this is after the book, and he realized he'd been had, that we knew who he was, and we had published all this material. And the guy from Great Britain phones him up, and he says, Dr. Walker, he says, I got another question for you. He said, I don't know whether this has anything to do with what we're talking about, but were you in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania in 1965? And Walker says, yeah, I was there. I was there with two off-duty military people. And then the guy says, well, Dr. Barker, I know you don't like to talk about this, but let me ask you, I mean, can I ask you, was it a UFO? And then Walker says, I told you, I don't talk about this subject. You're always trying to squeeze this out of me. I'm not going to talk about it. And then as a dadle, the guy who was doing the interview says, well, you know, Dr. Walker, says, I'm kind of like a turtle. You kick me over, I'm lying on my back, and I just roll back and forth until I finally get back on my feet again. So this is sort of the game. To me, it's been sort of a game to play to figure out who knows what's going on, and then to get information and to try to run that to ground. Where I think sometimes we've made the mistake in the UFO community. I sort of talk about sometimes that we deal with the messiah, that we're always looking for the next case. We're looking for the thing, that the crash that the government can't control, or the witness that's got all the story, that, or the researcher who's going to be the guy with no bad background, who's going to bring just the right witnesses out. And so we're always hopeful of all this kind of stuff. And then what happens is, you know, you get Stephen Greer with the disclosure news conference, and everybody's excited, and you figure, here it is, we're going to have disclosure. And then suddenly there's a couple of witnesses aren't maybe vetted quite right, and everybody goes, I knew he wasn't the Messiah. And suddenly everybody's against Stephen Greer, or, you know, the whole thing with the citizens hearing. You know, everybody thinks it's great, and then you find out, well, some people get critical, and then it's like, oh, no, that's not right. And we just keep jumping from one story to another story, and that's why I think it's so easy for the government to set us up, because we're always looking for the Messiah. We're looking for this story that everybody hasn't found yet. We're looking under all the rocks, and we haven't gone back and actually investigated the stories we already have that basically tell us what's going on. And that would even come down to the MJ-12 thing, which I told you in the original book. We put the stuff about MJ-12, and everybody said, oh, the document is phony. Don't even bring up the MJ-12 story. And it's like, yes, we know the MJ-12 story is – the document is phony, but nobody looked at the evidence that we had brought forward for MJ-12. And some of it is extremely significant evidence that basically says, yes, MJ-12 exists. And let me give you a couple of examples. There was a guy by the name of John Andrews, who was the guy from – Tester Corporation, who was a friend of Ben Rich at Lockheed Skunk Works. And he's the guy that did the model, the most popular tester model of the Roswell crash thing. He made the model, and he was an aerospace expert. He was very into it. He knew Ben Rich, and he writes a letter in 1987, which we put in the new book, that basically says, and this is when the document was released, the MJ-12 document was released, he said, I've known of MJ-12 for years, even though it wasn't public. I've known about it. So you have a high-ranking guy who's saying, before the document was out, we all knew about MJ-12. We knew there was this control group. And then in the most recent, there's an article I've just released on my website, which is presidentialufo.com. I bring out two very recent. In the book, we have about 12 items that show that there is a control group, and it is called MJ-12. And this involves, you know, John Andrews and a guy from inside the vault who comes and talks to me in Arizona at one, or Arkansas during, after one presentation, and people like that that confirm this. And the latest two are very significant. At the citizens' hearing, I contacted Jesse Marcel Jr. Jesse Marcel Jr. had told this story that dealt with this Dick D'Amato that had gone to Area 51. And Dick D'Amato had tried to get to the bottom of the whole UFO story. He goes to Area 51. He interviews a lot of the major researchers. And he actually makes a statement to Stephen Greer at the end. He says, I had the highest security clearances in the country. I had access to whoever I wanted to talk to. I was able to get nothing on this. And he says to Stephen Greer, I just want to let you know, you are up against the varsity team of all black budget programs. I wish you luck. And then he laughs. And so D'Amato, there's a story that D'Amato takes Jesse Marcel Jr. into a room in the Senate building, a secure room, and tells him the story. So I contact Jesse Marcel Jr. and I want to use it in my testimony at the citizens' hearing. I want to tell the story. So I send an email. I talked to one of Jesse Marcel's people that sort of booked stuff for him and stuff like that. And he says, well, I'll ask Jesse about it. Jesse never replies. But then Jesse gets to the citizens' hearing and he tells the story. He stands up and he tells the story. He says, I was contacted by this Dick D'Amato. Dick D'Amato brings me to Washington. He says, I want to talk to you. And so he goes to Washington and he says, we're going to go to the secure room. They take him to the secure room. 229, I think, is the room. And Jesse says, I want to talk to you about Roswell. Jesse says, well, I've said everything I've said about Roswell. I can't tell you anything new. And he said, no, I want to tell you something. And he's got the book by Whitley Strieber called Majestic. The book is sitting on the table. And he points at the book and he says, I just want to let you know, Jesse, this is true. This is not fiction. Whitley Strieber had written the book as fiction. And what the story is, it's not the Roswell story. If he had been the Roswell story, he would have put a Roswell book on the table. He put the Majestic book on the table. And the story is, Whitley Strieber's talking about his uncle or whatever this relative was, this guy at high-ranking guy at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, who tells him the Roswell is for real, the material is brought to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and that there is this Majestic group that is running the show, this control group that runs the UFO program. So when D'Amato says, this is for real, and he points to the Majestic book, he's saying, and he says to, or Jesse asks him, Jesse says, well, when are you going to make this public? And D'Amato says, well, if it was up to me, I would have done it yesterday. But that's not my job. I'm just here. I was just hired to find out what's going on and what this security is costing the United States of America. There's nothing I can really do about it, but I want to tell you that there is a black group with no responsibility to the government. They're not elected, that has unlimited amounts of money, that is running this program. And he tells that to Jesse. And Jesse testifies. If you go Jesse Marcel and you get his testimony, he tells his story. That was the one new piece I added. The other new piece I added was spectacular piece. It's John Alexander. John Alexander, and you probably know him. John is a guy who's been in UFOs since 1947. He's a guy who, I always say, the number one question in ufology is, what are UFOs? Mm-hmm. Number two question in ufology is, what the hell is John Alexander up to? It's always been the rumor. Like, what is he doing? Is he working for the government? Is he black ops? Is he, you know, whatever. And John is always there. I was just in Los Angeles for James Fox was doing his movie, The 701.
Right.
And I go there and I'm doing my little thing and I'm on the set at the studio there. And there's John Alexander sitting in the shadows. I mean, he's offset in the dark and he's taking notes. He was most of the interviews. He was there and he was being interviewed as well, but he was sitting there listening to everybody else's interviews. And there was kind of discussion behind the scenes, like, what the hell is he doing here? Like, I mean, is he spying on us and all this sort of stuff? So there's always this thing that John is kind of the guy who's working for the government and reporting on everybody and all this kind of stuff. But he always plays the skeptic. John will always say UFOs are real, but the government doesn't care. The government is not covering up anything. They don't care. There's no money going into that. There's no cover up.
Alexander's former military, right?
Yeah, he's a colonel in the U.S. Army. He was Green Beret. He was involved in a lot of the paranormal type research, and he was always famously known as the guy who was in charge of the non-lethal weapon program for the U.S. military. So he had all this sort of stuff, and a lot of people sort of tied him into the MILAB program, were saying that he was running the MILAB program, and John has sort of handled all this, I think, quite well. I mean, he's an okay guy. I like John, but it was always the thing is, what's John actually up to? Is he, you know, is he reporting on us? Is he doing whatever? Because he plays this thing like it's all for real, and he writes the book on UFOs, And he's quite eloquent in the book. But in the book, he doesn't talk about MJ-12. He talks about the Roswell. He says that there's no Roswell. There are no alien abductions. There's no MILAB. There are UFOs. It's the government. It's very, elusive problem that we don't even know how to ask the right questions. But the government doesn't care about it. That's his basic premise. In his book that he released, I guess it's about 2 years ago, he doesn't talk about MJ-12. But in a recent interview, he's asked about MJ-12, and he says, well, I didn't think it existed, but it does. And I couldn't believe it. John Alexander's actually admitting that MJ-12 exists. Hmm. Now, of course, he spins it different. He says, she said, well, do you think this is Nancy DeTetra was interviewing him. And she says, well, do you think that the government, there's still an MJ-12? And he says, well, no, I don't think there was an MJ-12. Someone just whispered in my ear that it existed. And he asked the guy, are the names right? Now, there's always a controversy when the MJ-12 document came out in 1987 about the names, because one of them was Menzel, who was a big skeptic, and it was always like, what would Menzel be doing on the committee? But John Alexander gets a confirmation from whoever it was that whispered in his ear that said, yeah, the names are right. And the guy says the name should tell you what was going on. So, of course, the way John Alexander handles it is he says, yes, it was an MJ-12. The names on the document were correct, but it was to cover up another program. It was a continuity of government program. It was a program that a very high security, top secret program that the government had to stop a nuclear decapitation from the Soviets. So it was this, how would we save the government if we were attacked nuclearly? So that was his interpretation of what this MJ-12 committee was. But he's actually now admitting that, yes, someone whispered in his ear that MJ-12 did exist. And this is a guy who is pretty skeptical on everything else in the field. There's no cover-up, there's nothing, but will actually admit, yes, there was an MJ-12.
Wow, that's interesting. Well, thanks so much. I really enjoyed our talk today. We'll have you back to talk about the president's involvement in the UFOs over the years.
Okay, Mark. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Take care.